how the little lambs feel about their sheepdog when the wolf is at the door. Look at what happened after September 11, 2001, when the wolf found it hard at the door. Remember how Americans, more than ever before, felt differently about their law enforcement officers and military personnel. Remember how many times you heard the word hero. And how long did that last? Give credit where it's due. A lot of people stayed alert to the threat and kept their hearts and heads right. But many of them, far too many of them, quickly forgot. They are sheep. They sink back into denial. They are sheep. They have two speeds, graze and stampede. Understand that there is nothing morally superior about being a sheepdog. It is just what you choose to be. Also understand that the sheepdog is a funny critter. He's always sniffing around out on the perimeter, checking the breeze, barking at things that go bump in the night, and yearning for a righteous battle. That is, the young sheepdogs yearn for a righteous battle. The old sheepdogs are a little older and wiser, but they move to the sound of the guns when needed, right along with the young ones. Here is how the sheep and the sheepdog think differently. The sheep pretend the wolf will never come, but the sheepdog lives for that day. After the attacks on September 11th, 2001, most of the sheep, that is, most citizens in America, said, "Thank God I wasn't on one of those planes." The sheepdogs, the warriors, said, "Dear God, I wish I could have been on one of those planes. Maybe I could have made a difference." When you are truly transformed into a warrior and have truly invested yourself into warriorhood, you want to be there. You want to be able to make a difference. While there is nothing morally superior about the sheepdog, the warrior, he does have one real advantage, only one. He is able to survive and thrive in an environment that destroys 98% of the population. There was research conducted a few years ago with individuals convicted of violent crimes. These cons were in prison for serious predatory acts of violence, assaults, murders, and killing law enforcement officers. The vast majority said that they specifically targeted victims by body language, slumped walk, passive behavior, and lack of awareness. They chose their victims like big cats do in Africa, when they select one out of the herd that is least able to protect itself. However, when there were cues given by potential victims that indicated they would not go down easily, the cons said that they would walk away. If the cons sensed that the target was a counter-predator, that is, a sheepdog, they would leave him alone unless there was no other choice but to engage. Some people may be destined to be sheep, and others might be genetically primed to be wolves or sheepdogs. But I believe that most people can choose which one they want to be. And I'm proud to say that more and more Americans are choosing to become sheepdogs. 7 months after the attack on September 11, 2001, Todd Beamer was honored in his hometown of Cranberry, New Jersey. Todd, as you recall, was the man on Flight 93 over Pennsylvania who called on his cell phone to alert an operator from United Airlines about the hijacking. When he learned of the other three passenger planes that had been used as weapons, Todd dropped his phone and uttered the words, "Let's roll," which authorities believe was a signal to the other passengers to confront the terrorist hijackers. In 1 hour, a transformation occurred among the passengers, athletes, business people, and parents, from sheep to sheepdogs. And together they fought the wolves, ultimately saving an unknown number of lives on the ground and giving the enemy their first defeat and becoming America's first frontline combatants in the global war on terror. Do you have any idea how hard it would be to live with yourself after that? There is no safety for honest men except by believing all possible evil of evil men. Edmund Burke, Reflections on the Revolution in France. Here is the point I try to emphasize, especially to the thousands of police officers and soldiers I speak to each year. In nature, the sheep, real sheep, are born as sheep. Sheepdogs are born that way, and so are wolves. They didn't have a choice. But you are not a critter. As a human being, you can be whatever you want to be. It is a conscious, moral decision. If you want to be a sheep, then you can be a sheep, and that is okay. But you must understand the price you pay. When the wolf comes, you and your loved ones are going to die if there is not a sheepdog there to protect you. If you want to be a wolf, you can be one. But the sheepdogs will hunt you down, and you will never have rest, safety, trust, or love. But if you want to be a sheepdog and walk the warrior's path, then you must make a conscious and moral decision every day to dedicate, equip, and prepare yourself to thrive in that toxic, corrosive moment when the wolf comes knocking at the door. For example, many officers carry their weapons in church. They are well concealed in ankle holsters, shoulder holsters, or inside the belt holsters, tucked into the small of their backs. Any time you go to some form of religious service, there is a very good chance that a police officer in your congregation is carrying. You will never know if there is such an individual in your place of worship until the wolf appears to slaughter you and your loved ones. I was training a group of police officers in Texas, and during the break, one officer asked his friend if he carried his weapon in church. The other officer replied, "I will never be caught without my gun in church." I asked why he felt so strongly about this, and he told me about a police officer that he knew who was at a church massacre in Fort Worth, Texas, in 1999. In that incident, a mentally deranged individual came into the church and opened fire, gunning down 14 people. He said that officer believed he could have saved every life that day if he had been carrying his gun. His own son was shot, and all he could do was throw himself on the boy's body and wait for him to die. That cop looked me in the eye and said, "Do you have any idea how hard it would be to live with yourself after that?" Some individuals would be horrified if they knew this police officer was carrying a weapon in church. They might call him paranoid and would probably scorn him. Yet these same individuals would be enraged and would call for heads to roll if they found out that the airbags in their cars were defective, or that the fire extinguisher and fire sprinklers in their kid's school did not work. They can accept the fact that fires and traffic accidents can happen, and that there must be safeguards against them. Not a single person has been killed by school fire or church fire in America in over 50 years, but hundreds and hundreds have been killed by violence in schools and churches. Yet their only response to the wolf is denial. And all too often their response to the sheepdog is scorn and disdain. But the sheepdog quietly asks himself, "Do you have any idea how hard it would be to live with yourself if your loved ones were attacked and killed and you had to stand there helplessly because you were unprepared for that day?" The warrior must cleanse denial from his thinking. Coach Bob Lindsay, a renowned law enforcement trainer, says that warriors must practice when-then thinking, not if-then. Instead of saying, "If it happens, then I will take action," the warrior says, "When it happens, then I will be ready." It is denial that turns people into sheep. Sheep are psychologically destroyed by combat because their only defense is denial, which is counterproductive and destructive, resulting in fear, helplessness, and horror when the wolf shows up. Denial kills you twice. It kills you once at your moment of truth, when you are not physically prepared. You didn't bring your gun. You didn't train. Your only defense was wishful thinking. Hope is not a strategy. Denial kills you a second time, because even if you do physically survive, you are psychologically shattered by fear, helplessness, horror, and shame at your moment of truth. Chuck Yeager, the famous test pilot and first man to fly faster than the speed of sound, says that he knew he could die. There was no denial for him. He did not allow himself the luxury of denial. This acceptance of reality can cause fear, but it is a healthy, controlled fear that will keep you alive. I was always afraid of dying, always. It was my fear that made me learn everything I could about my airplane and my emergency equipment, and kept me flying respectful of my machine and always alert in the cockpit. Brigadier General Chuck Yeager, Yeager, an autobiography. Gavin De Becker puts it like this in Fear Less, his superb post-9/11 book. Denial can be seductive, but it has an insidious side effect. For all the peace of mind deniers think they get by saying it isn't so, the fall they take when faced with new violence is all the more unsettling. Denial is a save-now, pay-later scheme, a contract written entirely in small print, for in the long run, the denying person knows the truth on some level. And so the warrior must strive to confront denial in all aspects of his life and prepare himself for the day when evil comes. If you are a warrior who is legally authorized to carry a weapon, and you step outside without that weapon, then you become a sheep, pretending that the bad man will not come today. No one can be on 24/7 for a lifetime. Everyone needs downtime. But if you are authorized to carry a weapon, and you walk outside without it, just take a deep breath and say this to yourself, "Bah." This business of being a sheep or a sheepdog is not a yes-no dichotomy. It is not an all-or-nothing, either-or choice. It is a matter of degrees, a continuum. On one end is an abject, head-in-the-grass sheep, and on the other end is the ultimate warrior. Few people exist completely on one end or the other. Most of us live somewhere in between. Since 9/11, almost everyone in America took a step up that continuum, away from denial. The sheep took a few steps towards accepting and appreciating their warriors, and the warriors started taking their job more seriously. The degree to which you move up that continuum, away from sheephood and denial, is the degree to which you and your loved ones will survive, physically and psychologically, at your moment of truth. You are not a warrior until you taste them. An SAS soldier's prayer. Give me, my God, what you still have. Give me what no one asks for. I do not ask for wealth, nor for success, nor even health. People ask you so often, God, for all that, that you cannot have any left. Give me, God, what you still have. Give me what people refuse to accept from you. I want insecurity and disquietude. I want turmoil and brawl. And if you should give them to me, my God, once and for all, let me be sure to have them always. For I will not always have the courage to ask for them. Give me, my God, what you have left over. Give me what others want nothing to do with. But give me courage too, and strength and faith, for you alone can give what one cannot demand from oneself. Prayer found on Lieutenant Andre Zernheld, SAS, killed in action, July 26, 1941. While the sheep does not always care for the sheepdog, the warrior cares about the sheep. He hurts, suffers, and weeps for those he is sworn to protect. Here is a powerful narrative that circulated on several law enforcement forums on the internet. I have not been able to identify the author, but this anonymous police officer captures the heart and soul of those warriors who lay it on the line for us every day. The department was all astir. There was a lot of laughing and joking due to all the new officers, myself included, hitting the streets today for the first time. After months of a seemingly endless amount of classes, paperwork, and lectures, we were finally done with the police academy and ready to join the ranks of our department. All you could see were rows of cadets with huge smiles and polished badges. As we sat in the briefing room, we could barely sit still as we anxiously waited our turn to be introduced and given our beat assignment, or for the layperson, our own portion of the city to serve and protect. It was then that he walked in, a statue of a man, 6'3" and 230 pounds of solid muscle. He had black hair with highlights of gray and steely eyes that made you feel nervous, even when he wasn't looking at you. He had a reputation for being the biggest and the smartest officer to ever work our fair city. He had been in the department for longer than anyone could remember, and those years of service had made him into somewhat of a legend. The new guys, or rookies as he called us, both respected and feared him. When he spoke, even the most seasoned officers paid attention. It was almost a privilege when one of the rookies got to be around when he would tell one of his police stories about the old days. But we knew our place and never interrupted for fear of being shooed away. He was respected and revered by all who knew him. After my first year on the department, I still had never heard or saw him speak to any of the rookies for any length of time. When he did speak to them, all he would say was, "So, you want to be a policeman, do you, Hero? I'll tell you what. When you can tell me what they taste like, then you can call yourself a real policeman." This particular phrase I had heard dozens of times. Me and my buddies all had bets about what the phrase, "what they taste like," actually referred to. Some believed it referred to the taste of your own blood after a hard fight. Others thought it referred to the taste of sweat after a long day's work. Being on the department for a year, I thought I knew just about everyone and everything. So one afternoon, I mustered up the courage and walked up to him. When he looked down at me, I said, "You know, I think I paid my dues. I've been in plenty of fights, made dozens of arrests, and sweated my butt off just like everyone else. So what does that little saying of yours mean, anyway?" With that, he merely stated, "Well, seeing as how you've said and done it all, you tell me what it means, Hero." When I had no answer, he shook his head and snickered, "Rookies," and walked away. The next evening was to be the worst one to date. The night started out slow, but as the evening wore on, the calls became more frequent and dangerous. I made several small arrests and then had a real knockdown drag-out fight. However, I was able to make the arrest without hurting the suspect or myself. After that, I was looking forward to just letting the shift wind down and getting home to my wife and daughter. I had just glanced at my watch, and it was 11:55. 5 more minutes, and I would be on my way to the house. I don't know if it was fatigue or just my imagination, but as I drove down one of the streets on my beat, I thought I saw my daughter standing on someone else's porch. I looked again. It wasn't her, but it was a child about my daughter's age, 6 or 7 years old, and dressed in an oversized shirt that hung to her feet. She was clutching an old rag doll that looked older than me. I immediately stopped my patrol car to see what she was doing alone outside her house at such an hour. When I approached, there seemed to be a sigh of relief on her face. I had to laugh to myself, thinking she sees the hero policeman come to save the day. I knelt at her side and asked what she was doing outside. "My mommy and daddy just had a really big fight. And now mommy won't wake up," she said. My mind was reeling. Now what do I do? I instantly called for backup and ran to the nearest window. As I looked inside, I saw a man standing over a lady with his hands covered in blood, her blood. I kicked open the door, pushed the man aside, and checked for a pulse, but I was unable to find one. I immediately cuffed the man and began doing CPR on the lady. It was then I heard a small voice from behind me. "Mr. Policeman, please make my mommy wake up." I continued to perform CPR until my backup and medics arrived, but they said it was too late. She was dead. I looked at the man who said, "I don't know what happened. She was yelling at me to stop drinking and to get a job, and I had just had enough. I shoved her so she would leave me alone, and she fell and hit her head." As I walked the man out to the car in handcuffs, I again saw that little girl. In the 5 minutes that had passed, I had gone from hero to monster. Not only was I unable to wake up her mommy, but now I was taking her daddy away too. Before I left the scene, I thought I would talk to the little girl. To say what? I don't know. Maybe just to tell her I was sorry about her mommy and daddy. But when I approached, she turned away. I knew it was useless, and that I would probably make it worse. As I sat in the locker room at the station, I kept replaying the whole thing in my mind. Maybe if I would have been faster or done something different, just maybe the little girl would still have her mother. And even though it may sound selfish, I would still be the hero. I felt a large hand on my shoulder, and I heard that all too familiar question. "Well, hero, what do they taste like?" Before I could get mad or shout some sarcastic remark, I realized that all the pent-up emotions had flooded to the surface, and there was a steady stream of tears rolling down my face. It was at that moment that I realized the answer to his question. Tears. He started to walk away, but then stopped. "You know, there was nothing you could have done differently," he said. "Sometimes you can do everything right, and the outcome doesn't change. You may not be the hero you once thought you were, but now you are a police officer." Author unknown. The sheepdog is cursed and blessed with the capacity for violence and a profound love for the flock. That is what makes the warrior different from the wolf. Since all the school massacres and the terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center, the sheep have figured out that the wolf is not only at the door, but he is also in the house and in their kids' schools. The wolf is loose, and now the sheep, or at least most of them, suddenly like their sheepdog, at least for a while. We are becoming a nation that is appreciating their warriors in a way that has not been seen since the end of World War II, and that is a good thing. As long as they are righteous warriors, noble warriors, who love their flock and are truly dedicated to their protection. Knights and Paladins. Nothing is so strong as gentleness, nothing so gentle as real strength. Francis de Sales. The 7-year-old girl clutched a piece of metal wrapped in a handkerchief tightly to her chest as she retold the horrible details of sexual abuse she had suffered 4 years earlier. When she glanced at the faces of the jurors or felt the hot stare of the defendant, she squeezed the handkerchief ever more tightly and locked her eyes on the face of Michigan State Police Trooper Jeffrey Miazga. St. Joseph County Prosecutor Douglas Fisher knew his August 2002 case against the pedophile rested squarely on the testimony of the young girl who had frozen on the stand an hour earlier, unable then to utter anything but her name. St. Joseph County Circuit Judge James Knocker granted Fisher a recess, but more than an hour of begging, cajoling, and reasoning by the victim's adoptive parents and her psychologist were unable to temper her terror and convince her to return to the stand. Fisher watched as his case unraveled, knowing dismissal would free the perpetrator and leave the child's psychological and physical wounds unassuaged. Just as Fisher was preparing to return to the courtroom without his young witness, the man in the blue trooper's uniform pulled his chair close to the girl and acknowledged that he also felt fear at times as a police officer. He bent over and spoke to her in a very quiet and private manner, Fisher recalled. He shared with her his secret, that many of the things he had to do as a Michigan State trooper made him very much afraid. As the young girl's eyes widened and her tears slowed, Miazga removed the silver shield from his uniform shirt, wrapped it in a handkerchief, and placed it in her hand. He told her how his Michigan State Police badge is what protected him and kept him safe, Fisher said. He told her the thought of his badge protecting him gave him the courage to go ahead and do his job. Trooper Miazga told her whenever she became afraid, she should squeeze the badge and that would give her the courage to go ahead and testify. She took the badge, held it tightly, and promised him she would try. Miazga was honored by the St. Joseph County Criminal Justice Council Friday for his empathy and creativity, which allowed the young girl to return to the stand in August, delivering testimony which convinced a jury to convict Sean Roberts of first-degree criminal sexual conduct. The case, which resulted in a life sentence for Roberts, remains emotional for Fisher, who wiped tears from his eyes Friday as Lieutenant Mike Risco, White Pigeon State Police Post Commander, read aloud Fisher's commendation letter. When he admitted to her his secret fear and the way that he was able to overcome it, he was able to lend her both his badge and his courage. From the article, Michigan State Police Trooper Earns Honors, Kathy Jessup, Sturgis Journal, Sturgis, Michigan. The best model for the warrior to internalize is that of the knights of old. The knight donned armor, hung a weapon on his hip, and a shield on his left side. On that shield was the authority by which he went forth and did good deeds and administered justice in the land. Eventually, gunpowder defeated armor, and the knights went away. Today, for the first time in centuries, there are warriors, law enforcement officers, who don armor every day, hang a weapon on their hip, and a shield on their left side. And on that shield is the authority by which they go forth and administer justice and do good deeds. If that is not a knight, a paladin, if that is not a new order of chivalry, then what is? The ancient knight is part myth and part truth. Some knights were brutal thugs, but many of them were true paladins, struggling to maintain a standard for nobility and decency that echoes down to this very day. One of those who set a widely accepted standard for knighthood as a protector of the innocent was the Dutch theologian Desiderius Erasmus. He is the author of Enchiridion Militis Christiani, which translates roughly to Guide for the Righteous Protector, written in 1503. This profoundly influential manual guided the knight, the police officer of the day, by establishing 22 principles for being strong and remaining virtuous in a dangerous world. In 1514, the artist Albrecht Dürer, inspired by Erasmus, carved the image of the knight, death, and the devil. The subject has been interpreted as the knight, with his dog, embarking on a righteous mission, invulnerable to the rotting corpse of death riding beside him, mortality, and the horned devil behind, temptation. The knight appears to be riding through the valley of the shadow of death, yet he fears not. Determined in his righteous mission, the knight looks ahead, drawing on his faith to give him the moral courage to confront evil. A full list of Erasmus's 22 principles can be found in Appendix A in the PDF included with this audiobook. For now, consider these sample guidelines for the behavior of a paladin, written 500 years ago, and see how they still apply to warriors today. Make virtue the only goal of your life. Dedicate all your enthusiasm, all your effort, your leisure, as well as your business. Train your mind to distinguish good and evil. Let your rule of government be determined by the common good. Never let any setback stop you in your quest. We are not perfect. This only means that we should try harder. Always be prepared for an attack. Careful generals set guards, even in times of peace. Spit, as it were, in the face of danger. Keep a stirring quotation with you for encouragement. Treat each battle as though it were your last, and you will finish, in the end, victorious. Don't assume that doing good allows you to keep a few vices. The enemy you ignore the most is the one who conquers you. Never admit defeat, even if you have been wounded. The good soldier's painful wounds spur him to gather his strength. Speak with yourself this way. If I do what I am considering, would I want my family to know about it? Life can be sad, difficult, and quick. Make it count for something. Since we do not know when death will come, act honorably every day. Many warrior cultures nurture such values. The Sikhs put it this way. He is the true hero who fights to protect the helpless. Great warriors are those whose humility is their breastplate. Without fear, they advance. By conquering the vices, they find they have also conquered the whole world. Guarding the gates and fighting in the shade. Miles to go before we rest, but it is easy, for we fight in the shade. Lieutenant Colonel Mark Byington, Missouri Police Corps. The Spartans are another ancient warrior culture that we can learn from. At Thermopylae, a narrow pass above the crystalline Aegean Sea, in 480 BC, 300 Spartans volunteered to delay the invading army of Xerxes, king of Persia. For 2,500 years, they have been called the 300 Immortals. There was no question the Spartans would perish. The Persians told them, "There are so many of us that when we fire our arrows, it darkens the sky." "Good," replied one old Spartan warrior, "then we will fight in the shade." The Persians felt great admiration and respect for the Spartan courage and audacity. They told the Spartans that they would be given great wealth and a place of honor in the Persian army if they just laid down their shields and handed over their swords. "Mulan Labe," replied the Spartan king, "come and get them." So the Persians attacked, and the Spartans fought, buying precious days for the rest of the Greek civilization to prepare. For several days, the Spartans held against outrageous odds as wave after wave of fresh Persian troops broke upon the Spartan shield wall. But finally, their line collapsed and they died to a man, including their king. The Persians buried them where they fell and moved on. Days later, the Greeks defeated the Persian army, and today these words are carved in a plaque mounted to the walls of Thermopylae. "Go tell the Spartans, stranger passing by, that here, obedient to their laws, we lie." Nearly 2,500 years later, on September 1st, 2001, 3,000 of our citizens died in a single day. Among them were more than 300 immortals, firefighters and police officers, who charged up the steps of the World Trade Center, clearing blockage, expediting the flow, saving hundreds, perhaps thousands of lives. Peggy Noonan crafted these powerful words to articulate why the actions of these modern-day immortals were so remarkable. "They weren't there. They went there. They didn't run from the fire. They ran into the fire. They didn't run down the staircase. They ran up the staircase. They didn't lose their lives. They gave them." The first building came down and it darkened the sky, and they fought in the shade. The second building fell, and more than 300 immortals lay buried in the rubble, including their chief. "Go tell the Spartans, stranger passing by, that here, obedient to their laws, we still lie. There are still warriors in the land who will move to the summons of the trumpet, who will march to the sound of the guns. Obedient to their laws." What are the laws to which these warriors remained obedient unto death? Well, the Spartan knights considered their shield to be sacred. It protected not just them, but their brother on their left, their city, and their civilization. Stephen Pressfield, in his superb book, The Gates of Fire, translates a Spartan oath about their shield. Read these words. Read the law of the shield and think about those firefighters and police officers bearing the shield as they went up the steps of the World Trade Center. This is my shield. I bear it before me in battle, but it is not mine alone. It protects my brother on my left. It protects my city. I will never let my brother out of its shadow, nor my city out of its shelter. I will die with my shield before me, facing the enemy. Today, police officers and firefighters are the shield. They bear the shield in defense of their cities, and they obey the law of the shield. Our military is the sword, rooting the enemy out of their holes in distant lands. They are joined and supported by judges, educators, emergency medical personnel, social workers, and countless other knights without armor in a savage land. They are all warriors, paladins of all kinds and professions, who are willing to risk life and limb for us. In these new dark ages, there is a new warrior who has risen to the occasion. While every other creature flees from the sound of the guns, the warrior goes 100 miles an hour to get to a gunfight, because combat, the universal human phobia, is his realm. The Marine hymn says that when we get to the gates of heaven, we are going to find them guarded by United States Marines. It may be that the highest honor a warrior can aspire to is to guard the pearly gates. Here on earth, the highest honor to which a warrior can aspire is to guard the gates of his city and his civilization in this dark hour. To do this formidable task competently, to be successful, the warrior must be the master of his realm, the realm of combat. On February 15th, 2002, about 25 men representing three different special forces and three CIA paramilitary units gathered outside of Gardiz in Afghanistan, in the east, about 40 miles from the Pakistani border. It was very cold, and they were bundled in camping or outdoor clothing. No one was in uniform. Many had beards. The men stood or kneeled on this desolate site in front of a helicopter. An American flag was standing in the background. There was a pile of rocks arranged as a tombstone over a buried piece of the World Trade Center. One of the men read a prayer. Then he said, "We consecrate this spot as an everlasting memorial to the brave Americans who died on September 11th, so that all who would seek to do her harm will know that America will not stand by and watch terror prevail. We will export death and violence to the four corners of the earth in defense of this great nation." Bob Woodward, Bush at War. Chapter 6, The Evolution of Combat, the Physical and Psychological Leverage that Enables Killing in War and Peace. This is the law. The purpose of fighting is to win. There is no possible victory in defense. The sword is more important than the shield, and skill is more important than either. The final weapon is the brain. All else is supplemental. John Steinbeck, The Law. Humans have proven themselves to be infinitely ingenious at creating and using devices to overcome their limitations. From one perspective, human history can be seen as a series of ever more efficient devices to help us communicate, travel, trade, work, and even to think. Similarly, the history of combat can be seen as the evolution of a series of ever more efficient devices to enable humans to kill and dominate their fellow human beings. In 1998, I was asked by the editors of the Academic Press Encyclopedia of Violence, Peace, and Conflict to write the entry on the evolution of weaponry. This chapter is an expanded and updated version of this encyclopedia entry. The concept of an evolution of combat is appropriate, since the battlefield is the ultimate realm of Darwinian natural selection. With few exceptions, any weapon or system that survives for any length of time does so because of its utility, not simply because of superstition. Anything that is effective is copied and perpetuated, and anything ineffective results in death, defeat, and extinction. There are fads and remnants, the military equivalent of the appendix, but over the long run, everything happens for a reason, and that reason is survival and victory in combat. Ultimately, the limitations of our bodies and our minds determines the nature of our weapons. Of these two, the mind is by far the more important. But first, let us examine the nature of man's physical limitations and the evolution of weapons to overcome these limitations. Weapons as devices to overcome physical limitations. I've long considered the giving of a weapon to be a solemn obligation and statement. The obligation is from the giver, who has to be sure that he can place his absolute trust in the discretion and judgment of the gifted. The statement is that the giver wishes the gifted warrior to prevail, to preserve themselves and to thrive. A weapon given is a measure of trust from one to another. I give the weapon as protection, as a practical means of survival, and as a means to say that the person gifted is important. Weapons are simple tools, not engraved, not pretty, but their importance throughout history is understated, except in one instance, and that is the rare, right, and reasoned use of a weapon by a warrior. Therein, ultimately, eventually, and in no other way, lies peace. Rocky Warren, police sergeant and law enforcement trainer. The physical limitations of man are a key factor in his search for weapons. The need for force, mobility, distance, and protection has been the key requirement in this realm. The need for force. Man's physical strength limitations led to a need for greater physical force in order to hit an opponent harder and more effectively, resulting in the development of better methods to transfer kinetic energy to an opponent. This process evolved from hitting someone with a handheld rock, providing the momentum energy of more mass than just a fist, to sharp rocks, focusing the energy in a smaller impact point, to a sharp rock on a stick, providing mechanical leverage combined with the cutting edge, to spears, using the latest material technology, flint, bronze, iron, steel, to focus energy into smaller and smaller penetration points, to swords, which permit the option of using a thrusting spear-like penetration point or the mechanical leverage of a hacking cutting edge, to the longbow, using stored mechanical energy and a refined penetration point, and finally to firearms, transferring chemical energy to a projectile in order to deliver an extremely powerful dose of kinetic energy. The need for mobility. Limited by the constraints of a bipedal body that could be outrun by a majority of ground-based creatures, man's cross-country speed created a need for a mobility advantage, resulting in a succession of weapons that provided more efficient means to go around the enemy or to give chase. These weapons evolved from the chariots of the Egyptians, Babylonians, and Persians, which were without horse collars, an invention of the Romans, and were thus quite inefficient since the mounting system choked the horse, to the cavalry of the Greeks and the Romans, whose horses lacked stirrups, limiting their ability to strike from horseback, to the cavalry which dominated the battlefield throughout the age of the European knights, since the introduction of stirrups made it possible to deliver a powerful blow from horseback without danger of falling off. And the cavalry continued to play a key but ever-decreasing role for over 500 years, up to the beginning of the 20th century, to modern mechanized infantry, tanks, and the ultimate form of mobility, aircraft. Simultaneously, a similar evolution of ever more effective forms of mobility took place with ships at sea, until the introduction of aircraft, originally based on aircraft carriers, and today, with the increasingly long-range ground-based aircraft that have come to dominate this realm. The need for distance. Similarly, man's limited reach created a need for a range advantage in an effort to attack more people than just those in immediate reach, that is, to increase the zone of influence, and to do so without placing himself in danger. This need resulted in an increasingly more efficient means to kill at a distance, moving from the spear to the long spear of the Greek phalanx, to the throwing spears of the Roman legionary, to the bow, the crossbow, the English longbow, firearms, artillery, missiles, and aircraft. The need for protection. Physical vulnerability resulted in a continuous need for armor to help limit an enemy's ability to inflict harm in the form of kinetic energy. This evolution generally followed the latest development of material technology to include leather, bronze, iron, and steel. The invention of firearms created a degree of force so great that the human body could not carry sufficient steel to stop a penetration. The only remnant of armor was the helmet, which was designed to stop fragmentation, grenade, and artillery wounds to the vulnerable and crucial brain area. This evolution continues today in tank and ship armor. In recent years, man-made fiber technology, such as Kevlar, has again made body armor practical, so that for the first time in centuries, the average combatant, in both law enforcement and military realms, can once again wear a form of body armor. Weapons as devices to overcome psychological limitations. Man is the first weapon of battle. Ardent Dupic, 1870, Battle Studies. Mobility, distance, and protection interact with each other in the evolution of weapons. But man's psychological limitations are even more influential in this process than his physical limitations. Earlier, I cited Lord Moran, and it is worth repeating that this great military physician of World War I and World War II called Napoleon the greatest psychologist. Napoleon said that, in war, the moral is to the physical as 3 is to 1, meaning that the psychological advantage or leverage is 3 times more important than the physical. At the heart of the psychological processes on the battlefield is the resistance to killing one's own species, a resistance that exists in most healthy members of most species. This was addressed in far greater detail in On Killing, but there is value in a brief recap and update here. To truly understand the nature of this resistance, we must first recognize that most participants in close combat are literally frightened out of their wits. Once the arrows or bullets start flying, combatants stop thinking with the forebrain, that part of the brain which makes us human, and thought processes localize in the midbrain, or mammalian brain, which is the primitive part of the brain that is generally indistinguishable from that of an animal. It may be that in conflict situations, this primitive midbrain processing can be observed in a consistent trend towards resisting and avoiding the killing of one's own species. During territorial and mating battles, animals with antlers and horns slam together in a relatively harmless head-to-head fashion. Rattlesnakes wrestle each other, and piranha fight their own kind with flicks of their tails. But against any other species, these creatures unleash their horns, fangs, and teeth without restraint. This is an essential survival mechanism, which prevents a species from destroying itself during territorial and mating rituals. This resistance can be seen in other places besides mating and territorial battles. Why is it that the biggest kitten in every litter does not smother and kill all the other kittens? Why is it that the biggest puppy does not kill all the other puppies in the litter to enhance its personal survival? Why does the first chick out of the egg not shove the other eggs out of the nest? That chick's personal survival would be greatly enhanced if it did. Now there is a breed of bird that lays eggs in other birds' nests. And when its eggs hatch, it shoves the other bird's eggs out. But those are eggs from a different type of bird. Creatures of the same species almost never kill their own kind intentionally. Why is it that you can leave your 3-year-old child with your 6-month-old infant for a few minutes, and the older one does not leap on the little one and smother or somehow kill it? Again, most healthy members of most species appear to have a hard-wired resistance against killing their own kind. Any species that did not have this hard-wired resistance would cease to exist within a couple of generations. Yes, once every couple of years we may hear of some horrendous incident in which a 3- or 4-year-old who has been negatively influenced in some way murders an infant child. But it is extremely rare. When these incidents occur, it shocks us right down to our core because it is a horrible abnormality. One major modern revelation in the field of military psychology is the observation that this resistance to killing one's own species is also a key factor in human combat. We have already addressed Brigadier General S.L.A. Marshall's findings in this area in World War II. Based on his innovative technique of post-combat interviews, Marshall concluded in his landmark book, Men Against Fire, that only 15-20% of the individual riflemen in World War II fired their weapons at an exposed enemy soldier. As I noted earlier, every available parallel scholarly study of combat firing rates validates Marshall's basic findings. Ardent Dupique's surveys of French officers in the 1860s and his observations on ancient battles, Keegan and Holmes's numerous accounts of ineffectual firing throughout history, Patty Griffith's data on the extraordinarily low killing rate among Napoleonic and American Civil War regiments, Stouffer's extensive World War II and post-war research, Richard Holmes's assessment of Argentine firing rates in the Falklands War, the British Army's laser reenactments of historical battles, the FBI's studies of non-firing rates among law enforcement officers in the 1950s and 1960s, and countless other individual and anecdotal observations all confirm Marshall's fundamental conclusion that man is not, by nature, a close-range interpersonal killer. Somewhere inside our midbrain, at least in the brains of healthy members of our species, we appear to have a powerful resistance to killing our own kind, just like most other species. While this is true, the question begs to be asked, why then have we been so good at filling up our military cemeteries across the years? The existence of this resistance can be observed in its marked absence in sociopaths who, by definition, feel no empathy or remorse for their fellow human beings. Pit bull dogs have been selectively bred for sociopathy, that is, bred for the absence of the resistance to killing one's own kind, to ensure that they will perform the unnatural act of killing another dog in battle. Breeding to overcome this limitation in humans is impractical, but humans are adept at finding mechanical means to overcome natural limitations. Humans were born without the ability to fly, so we found mechanisms that overcame this limitation and enabled flight. Humans were also born with constraints upon their ability to kill fellow humans. So throughout history, we have devoted great effort to finding ways to overcome this resistance. From a combat evolution perspective, the history of warfare can be viewed as a series of successively more effective tactical and mechanical mechanisms to enable or force combatants to overcome their resistance to killing. Posturing as a psychological weapon. I am sure that not numbers or strength bring victory in war, but whichever army goes into battle stronger in soul, their enemies generally cannot withstand them. Greek general Xenophon, 4th century BC, Anabasis. The resistance to killing can be overcome, or at least bypassed, by a variety of techniques. One way is to cause the enemy to flee, often by getting in their flank or rear, which almost always causes a rout. And it is in the subsequent pursuit of a broken or defeated enemy that the vast majority of the killing happens. It is widely understood that most killing happens after the battle in the pursuit phase. Clausewitz and Ardent Dupic both commented on this, which is apparently due to two factors. First, the fleeing victim has his back turned. It appears to be much easier to deny his humanity if you can stab or shoot him in the back and not look into his eyes when you kill him. Secondly, in the midbrain of the pursuer, the opponent apparently changes from a fellow male engaged in a primitive, simplistic, ritualistic, head-to-head, territorial, or mating battle to a prey that must be pursued, pulled down, and killed. Anyone who has ever worked with dogs understands this process. You are generally safe if you face a dog down in a threatening situation. When you have to move, back away from a dog, as with most animals, because if you turn and run, you are in danger of being pursued and viciously attacked. The same is true of soldiers in combat. The battlefield is truly psychological in nature. In this realm, the individual who puffs himself up the biggest or makes the loudest noise is likely to win. From one perspective, the actual battle is a process of posturing until one side or another turns and runs, and then the real killing begins. Thus, posturing is critical to warfare, and the side that does it best will gain a significant advantage on the battlefield. We have already addressed the bigger bang theory, but it is useful to recap and say that bagpipes, bugles, drums, shiny armor, tall hats, chariots, elephants, and cavalry have all been factors in successfully posturing, convincing oneself of one's prowess while daunting one's enemy. But ultimately, gunpowder proved to be the ultimate posturing tool. For example, the longbow and the crossbow were significantly more accurate, with a far greater rate of fire and a much greater accurate range than the muzzle-loading muskets used up to the early part of the American Civil War. Furthermore, the longbow did not need the industrial base, iron, and gunpowder required by muskets. Mechanically speaking, there is no reason why there should not have been regiments armed with longbows and crossbows at Waterloo and Bull Run, cutting vast swaths through the enemy. Similarly, there were highly efficient air pressure-powered weapons available as early as the Napoleonic era, similar to modern paintball guns, which had a far higher firing rate than the muskets of that era, but they were never used. We must keep in mind Napoleon's maxim that in war, the mental factors are three times more important than the mechanical factors. The reality is that if you go doink doink on the battlefield and the enemy goes bang bang, they gain a powerful psychological advantage that ultimately may mean that the doinkers lose. In his book, War on the Mind, Peter Watson says that one universal finding of weapons research is that the amount of noise a weapon makes is a key factor in that weapon's effectiveness on the battlefield. Noise of many kinds, usually incredibly loud, often painfully so, small arms, shells, bombs, and aircraft during an attack. This can be prepared for, but the first time in real battle is always different. This phenomenon helps explain the effectiveness of high noise producing weapons, ranging from Gustavus Adolphus small mobile cannons assigned to infantry units to the U.S. Army's M60 machine gun in Vietnam, which fired large and very loud 7